Well, this morning I'm going to talk about a very short verse, a haiku from one of the four masters of Japanese haiku, Issa. Some of you know that name, Issa. Zen practitioner, and of course most famous for his haiku, most famous more particularly for his inclusion of animals and his kindness for animals in his haiku. That's one of the things that's kind of a hallmark of Issa's verses. So on the front of your program there is our poem today. And if you do not have a program in front of you, I'll read it to you here a couple times. It's short, so you can just let it kind of soak into you. Issa writes, "A pigeon cries. Even deep in the thousand islands, it's Buddha's world." A pigeon cries. Even deep in the thousand islands, it's Buddha's world. There we go. Talk completed. We can all go home. It's a beautiful verse. What is probably helpful to know, this isn't where I'm going to take this today, but the Thousand Islands is a reference to a specific geographical location that's called the Thousand Islands. And the implication here, our understanding as readers, is that Issa is far from home. Right? He's not from the Thousand Islands. He is visiting the Thousand Islands from far away. That kind of changes our relationship a little bit with a pigeon cries. Even deep in the thousand islands, it's Buddha's world. So metaphorically speaking, I think it's safe to say we all are very acquainted with the thousand islands. I think it's easy to imagine yourself being there. We all know what it feels like to be far from home. Perhaps that means far from what is known. Perhaps that means far from what feels familiar. Perhaps that even means far from what is safe. A lot of us recognize the changing world right now as being a form of the thousand islands. I think it's safe to say that most of us feel a little differently about the world in which we live now than we did a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago. I don't know if that makes you feel like you're moving further and further into the heart of some of the landscapes of human experience. Maybe you don't feel like you chose to live with more vigilance, perhaps more fear, perhaps more visible affliction. Perhaps the divisions in the human experience are more evident to you now than they were a little while ago. It would make sense, you know? So we have an interesting invitation here from our friend Issa. Even deep in the thousand islands, it's Buddha's world. So I'm going to circle back to that. I'm going to, though, read this little passage. A lot of you know, very famous. Seems to say the same thing in kind of a different way. In this little passage reads, a monk introduced himself to the master Xuanzha, saying, "I have just entered this monastery. Please show me where to enter the way." "Do you hear the sound of the valley stream?" said Xuanzha. "Yep," said the monk. "Enter there." You want to know where to enter? That thing you hear? There. There's your entry point. You want to know where to enter the way? There it is. That thing you're hearing right now. Hear that pigeon cry? That's your door to the Buddha's world. Right? Immediate experience. Here we go. So, I got a bunch of stuff I'm going to throw at you around these things, but I'm going to start with something. I'm only going to spend a few minutes on this, because this could take the whole time. But we've been, some of the teachers here at Zen Center have been emailing back and forth about some of the Abhidharma breakdowns of consciousness in traditional Theravadan Buddhism. And Tim is talking about some of this stuff, the skandhas and that kind of stuff, in his class right now on the Heart Sutra. And so in the Abhidharma, we have what's something called the 18 dhatus. And it is a classification of all knowable things into 18 elements. If this is the kind of stuff that makes your head swim, then let it swim for a few minutes. I'll be done soon, I promise. Dhatu is spelled D-H-A-T-U. It is Sanskrit. It is usually translated as realm. The 18 realms, the 18 dhatus. The teaching here, and this is very, very, very ancient. This is early Buddhism. The teaching here is one of deconstruction, to try to see the error of the false self. Right? We spend a lot of time in traditional Buddhism breaking down the self into its component elements so that we see that there is a non-self self. Right? Those of you who know Buddhism are nodding and you get this. Those of you who don't worry, it'll be over soon. The non-self teaching has a particular place in early Buddhism, and it has a little bit of, a different place in Mahayana Buddhism that I'll get to. But here's the 18 dhatus, so you have a sense of what's going on. It's a little more straightforward than it at first appears. We have, in our culture, what we call the five senses. Right? Smell, taste, touch, sound, and what am I missing, you guys? Sight. Thank you. Those are the five senses, so we all agree on those things. Buddhism adds one more, just to be difficult. Mind. It adds mind to those. We have our normal five senses we're used to, and then it adds mind. So what that means is we have, from a Buddhist point of view, six sense objects, things in which we can be in relation, right? So that is form, sound, smell, taste, texture, and then a mental object or a thought. Right? Are you with me so far? Okay. We also, therefore, have six sense faculties. In other words, in order for it to be visible, I have to have eye. In order for it to be hearable, I have to have ear. In order for it to be touchable, I have to have skin. Do you get it? So we have six sense faculties, which is to say, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and then mind, mental. The mental faculties, right? So we have six objects, and we have six knowers of objects, right? So we're up to 12 so far. We're still missing something from Buddhist point of view because we need consciousness to connect them. It is not enough that I have a water glass. It is not enough that you have eyes. We need consciousness to connect your eyes to this glass. In order for you to be seeing this, you have to have eyes, there has to be a glass, and there must be consciousness. Does that make sense? So three things are actually happening, right? You have an eye faculty, and there's a glass, and you're awake. You are looking, you are seeing. There's a thing called eye consciousness that is beholding the glass. So Abhidharma, traditional Buddhist teaching and consciousness say, oh, all three of those things are happening right now. And so when I go, and you hear it, you've got ears, and Bhusha just snapped his fingers, and hearing consciousness connects those two things. Wow. Cool, right? So you have eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. Now we have 18 things. Six sense objects, six ways of knowing, and six forms of consciousness that connects those things. Wow. I'm saying wow because I think that's cool. It's a little clinical, I'll admit. It doesn't fill me with warmth necessarily in my chest. But what I think is cool is that thousands of years ago, people got so still that they watched that happen and went, oh, man, there's a lot happening right here. I mean, they're, you know, they weren't connected to electronic equipment figuring out what part of their brain was lit up. They just watched so carefully that they could see there has to be a cup, there has to be eyes, and there has to be consciousness. That, I just think, is really amazing. Holy cow. Right? Where am I going with all this? Well, the pigeon's cry and Issa's ears takes him to the realization it's Buddha's world. Consciousness. Disconnected those things. It's Buddha's world. There was a sound, and there's an Issa who heard it. Consciousness. It's Buddha's world. Isn't that cool? All of that happens immediately at the same time. Right? It's a call and response, but you don't really know which comes first, if you think about it. Whoosh, it arises because it's consciousness. It's Buddha's world, right? In Mahayana Buddhism, Issa is a Zen guy, so he's only a couple hundred years ago. He's definitely a Mahayana guy. Buddha is no longer referring to Shakyamuni, who died 2,500 years ago. We're talking about Big B Buddha here. Consciousness itself, awakeness itself, right? Everything. The undivided. He's talking about the absolute. It's Buddha's world. It's Buddha's world. It's Buddha's world, right? So we have the pigeon cry. We have Issa's ears. We have hearing consciousness. One, two, three. Now, the 18 dhatus were taught a long, long, long time ago. They are still taught, of course, in many traditions. It is a beautiful teaching. We are encouraged to meditate upon them, to call them into awareness, so that we begin to see the non-selfness of self. Again, some of you are nodding because you know this teaching. It's the heart of Buddhism. There is no self. Anatta, non-self. Strictly speaking, he said, I have looked and I cannot find it. The permanent, fixed, abiding self. I have looked and I cannot find it. All I see are these things happening. All I see are these things. There's consciousness, but that's pretty hard to identify as me particularly. So, kind of non-self. Wow. Pretty fascinating teaching. Very difficult to talk about. Difficult for us to understand. And also, we've got layers of emotional resistance to that. Because we're very attached to the idea of self. Right? So the idea of the skandhas, the idea of the dhatus, the ideas of all these early breakdowns, these deconstructions of experience, are to help us understand there is a wisdom that eliminates separation. Isn't that weird? By breaking things down further, we become less separate. And eliminating separation is a way of giving rise to compassion. Now I'm into the Mahayana. Why is it important for me to realize that on some level we are not separate? Because even without being told, that will immediately give rise, intuitively give rise, naturally give rise, organically give rise to compassion. Of course it will. We're not separate. Your pain and my pain are not two pains. Wow. You know, the pigeon's cry and Issa's ears, he has a moment of non-separateness. This is Buddha's world. So your joy and my joy, and your pain and my pain, and your fear and my fear, and your hope and my hope. Oh, it's Buddha's world. Do you see? Wow, isn't that fascinating that I can look so deeply into my experience that I can see that we're actually not separate, and to watch the arising of compassion. Why? Because compassion is appropriate response. From a Buddhist point of view, that's the appropriate response to suffering. Compassion. When suffering shows up, we meet it with compassion. When you see the red light, you stop the car. When the phone rings, you answer it. Appropriate response. It's natural. You don't even have to think about it. Suffering. Oh, suffering. Right? This is the thing Buddhism has been teaching for 2,500 years. When suffering shows up, you meet it with compassion. You lean toward it. You acknowledge it as not separate from you. Whose problem is that to solve? Yours. Whose else would it be? And of course, the closer you get to it, the less of a problem it becomes. The less solving is necessary, because just the meeting is enough to transform the experience. Right? This is why we meditate. Right? Appropriate response. This is the heart of the precepts, right? Why don't I steal from you? Because we're not separate. It doesn't work. Ah! Do you see what I mean? That totally ruins theft. It totally ruins it. Ah, darn. So one of the words that's used sometimes as a kind of a synonym in Zen for enlightenment is intimacy. I actually prefer it. I think enlightenment is a loaded and dangerous word. I really do. The longer I spend in this tradition, the more I think, oh man, I would have had a lot easier road if I had never heard the E word. That thing has done nothing but get in the way. A few of you are nodding like, oh yeah. Ah, it's so easy to reify that as being a separate thing, and it's so easy to reify that as an experience, and it's so easy to associate that with comfort and safety and everlasting non-harm, and then it's really, really easy to imagine that it's not me and that it will come later and that when I arrive there it will show up and never leave. I mean, these are the things we do with enlightenment, right? Oh, my Lord, and since none of those things are true, it takes me about 10 years worth of practice to just go, oh, I was a mess to start with. Okay, I get it, you know. So I love intimacy instead. How well do you see your experience? How aware are you of all the different layers of your experience right now? How intimate are you with those things? That's enlightenment. That's all it is. It's just awareness. One of the things I think is fascinating about his poem, at least for me as a 21st century Western reader, is I'm not sure what feeling he's trying to give me there, and maybe he's not trying to give me any. A pigeon cries, even deep in the Thousand Islands, it's Buddha's world. Is that a happy poem? Is that a sad poem? Does he feel close to the pigeon? Is the crying sorrow? Is the crying happiness? I mean, I'm reading it in English, right? So that's got different layers of meaning than the original Japanese would have, but is he just talking about a moment of non-separation? I don't actually know. But when I define enlightenment as intimacy, and the enlightened mind as intimacy, and haiku poetry as expressions of the enlightened mind, they become expressions of intimacy. And getting really close to and holding tenderly a moment of great sadness is enlightened activity. Right? I was really intimate with that sadness when it showed up. I was very gentle to it. I held it very carefully. Does that feel like enlightenment to you? It does to me. That feels a lot more like enlightenment to me than I never feel sad. And when it's there, I don't feel it. Do you feel the do you see the difference there? Ooh. That's a game changer, folks. Be careful of how you define enlightenment, right? Ooh. It underscores the entire trajectory of what it is you think you're doing here, right? Wow. Wow. Intimacy is a totally different invitation than the baggage we normally add to enlightenment, right? So we have Isa's iris, we have a pigeon's cry, and we have hearing consciousness. We have a saying in the Mule Verses at Zen Center, the three wheels. I don't know where it comes from. I should know this, but I don't. The three wheels, the giver, the receiver, and the gift. The three things, right? That which is being offered, the person who receives what's being offered, and the offering itself. The three different things. And they're empty, we always chant before the meal, you know, because we're about to be served, right? We're the receiver, and someone's going to come around with a big bowl of rice, and they're the giver, and we're the receiver, and the rice is the gift. And so we're reminded before we eat, they're empty. They're empty. Just so you know, they're non-separate. That's what I mean by empty. They're not fixed. They're not permanent. This is just a thing that's happening. They are empty, the giver, the receiver, and the gift. There's one thing happening, right? There's a pigeon cry, and there's an ear, and there's this hearing consciousness. There's only one thing, and there's a server, and there's a bowl being offered, and there's rice, but there's only one thing. Isn't that cool? The invitation is to experience this differently. That's why we chant it before the meal. How intimate are you about to be with your meal? How intimate are you about to be with the person who's offering you your meal? How intimate are you about to be with your experience? How close in can you go? Does that make sense? That's a very different invitation than how comfortable can you be right now? How enlightened can you be right now? Do you feel the difference? I love the humility of this. It's never a placing above. It's never a placing above. It's always... Because I can't touch you. I can't be intimate with you if I'm above, right? I'm looking down on you. I don't want to look down on you. Person, experience, mood, rice, pigeon cry. I'm a human, right? No human experience should be foreign to me. Why do I keep wanting to go up? What is that about? When Zen is so clear about saying intimate. So giver, receiver, and gift are empty, just like the Datus show us the cry, the ears, and the consciousness are. Or for me right now, the water glass and the taster of the water glass. The three wheels of lover, beloved, and love. You can find these in all moments of your experience if you start looking for them. They're always happening. The invitation is to an experience of no gap. No gap. Intimacy. Connection. No gap, right? And so where the poem takes me is when Issa has his experience of hearing the pigeon cry. Even deep in the Thousand Islands and recognizing Buddha's world. He is Buddha. It takes a Buddha to recognize Buddha. Right? Strength recognized strength. Legend recognized legend. Buddha recognized Buddha. It's just his moment of going, oh yeah, it's Buddha's world. He is that. The cry is Buddha. Of course, the Thousand Islands are Buddha. It's pretty hard for us to recognize this, I think, in our everyday life when we are deep in the Thousand Islands. And I don't know what the Thousand Islands is for you today. Maybe it's your intimate relationships. Maybe it's your newsfeed. Maybe it's fear. Maybe it's despair. Maybe it's hope. I don't know. If you look at your moment-to-moment experience really intimately, you'll see layers and layers and layers. Right? You're having a bunch of feelings right now. You're having a bunch of thoughts right now. You're having a bunch of sensations right now. There's a whole bunch happening. You are deep in the Thousand Islands. This is called the human experience. Right? The part of you that knows, oh, right. There's a way of responding to this that knows it's Buddha's world. That feels a little different to me than always needing to respond out of that preconditioned fear, out of the reactivity of the small self, out of the insistence of fight or flight. Does that make sense, kind of? Wow, this is the Thousand Islands. Wow, right now, this is Buddha's world. How do I regard the sad cry versus how do I regard the happy one? Do I move toward one and want to kick out the other? What do I do? Am I the gatekeeper of my own experience? What does that go back to? What is that about for me? What's my karma around that, right? These are pretty deep questions. The universe was made just to be seen by your eyes. There's only one Buddha, and you're it. So that's actually true, isn't it? If I was really a Yogacara guy, I could say the universe can only be seen by your eyes. That's it. All of this is actually your domain. Is that right? I mean, it is. Can you feel some part of the size of the invitation of that when you realize it's not separate from you? I mean, the scale of that actually creates fear in me. It creates wonder and awe, but sometimes it creates fear in me going, oh, all of this. Because I suddenly become aware of how much I hold at bay and how small my capacity actually is and how large the invitation is. Oh, wow. And then I start going, I wonder if this is why Buddhism, at least some forms of Buddhism, have that idea that you live more than once, you know? Because, like, oh, it's probably going to take a long time to figure this one out. And I don't know that I'm going to wrap that up in another 40 years. I just don't think that's going to... Wow, the project starts seeming pretty big. I don't know. Okay, so... A young monk is walking up a hill, and he comes across an old hermit carrying a heavy bag. The monk knows that the old hermit has been living in seclusion for many years and understands life. Already it's funny to me. I'm like, oh, come on, man. Where does this happen? I live in Eden Prairie. This never happens to me ever. Is this like a China thing? I don't know. Anyway, you already know where this is going, right? Like, dun-dun-dun. There's going to be some sort of weird kung fu exchange. It's, you know. Evidently, the hermit's like wearing a name tag. Hi, ask me about life. Because I know stuff. Anyway. Okay, so when their paths cross, the monk asks the hermit, what is enlightenment? The hermit puts down his heavy load and he stands up straight. What comes after enlightenment? Asks the monk. The old man picks up his bag and continues walking. There you go. End of story. That's not Dharma either. At least it's not Big D Dharma. The Buddha never said that. I don't know who made that up. I got it from Facebook. Nevertheless, I like it because it's picking it up and it's putting it down. And it's picking it up and it's putting it down. And it's picking it up and it's putting it down. And if I want, I can add all sorts of layers of meaning there, that the young monk recognizes that the old hermit understands life because he's carrying a burden. That's what people who are alive do. I don't have to tell you that because you're alive. You're alive, and you know you're carrying a burden, and you know you're in really good company, because every human being who has ever walked on this earth has carried a burden, without exception. In Buddhism, we call this the First Noble Truth. This is the universal experience. What is our relationship with that bag? It's interesting that enlightenment doesn't look like putting it down and walking away and never picking it back up again. It's interesting that enlightenment looks like, oh, I know. I know that I'm carrying it, and I understand what it is. And I can pick it up when I need to, and I can set it down when I need to. Does that make sense? There's a call, and there's a response. There's a pigeon cry in their ears. There's a burden, and there's one who says, I will pick this up and carry this, because it's mine. Right? Wow. Delusion and enlightenment. In Buddha's world, there is only that one thing. In our particular tradition, in Soto Zen, we have this troublemaker named Dogen, a lot of you know really, really well, who went really far out of his way, ad nauseum, to break down the separation we love to insist is there between delusion and enlightenment. There are two separate things. And Dogen was like, no, no, no. We were like, yes, they are. He went, no, they're not. And I said, you've been dead for 800 years. Shut up. No, I'm not. I'm still in your head. Quit telling yourself stories that hurt you about how they're different, about how deluded you are, and about how enlightenment will come someday and save you. Please stop doing that. You bet I've been dead for 800 years, but this is still true. And the more deeply you get this, the less afflictive you're going to find your life, the more compassion you're going to have for your own experience, and the more compassion you're going to be able to offer the people around you, because you won't be caught. And if you're free, you can help others to get free. That's the whole deal. Picking it down and picking it up again. Putting it down and picking it back up again. So Dogen says that being confused is delusion. And he says, and being aware that you're confused is enlightenment. Wow! Can you feel like that is a fly right in the ointment? I mean, at least for me, that is a fly right in the ointment. Because what I want him to say, I'm still angry at him. It's been 800 years he's been dead, which explains why he never answers my letters or texts. What I want him to say is, being confused is delusion, and never being confused is enlightenment. Thank you. That makes sense. Having pain is suffering. Never having pain is enlightenment. Thank you. That I can understand, right? Click, click. A yes or a no. An on or an off. That's what I want him to say. A nice dualistic understanding. You're not there, now you are there. Do you get it? And he refuses. He's just like, oh, if you're aware that you're confused, that's the activity of enlightenment. So where does Dogen say our enlightenment comes? In our delusion. You've heard people sitting on this weird little platform say that many, many times. Many, many times, especially that rascal over there, Tim Burkett, who is very fond of that. What an incredibly important teaching, right? Our enlightenment happens within our delusion. Oh, there's the understanding. I understand. I'm caught because of. I see it because of. Oh, this is why I... Do you see it? Hopefully, it's more than just see. It's feel. You can actually feel what happens in you when you recognize it. The difference between being pissed and recognizing, oh, I'm experiencing this right now, is a huge difference. Because in the latter, there is freedom, and there is possibility, and there is agency, and there is choice. It's Buddha's world now because I'm aware of what's happening. I'm no longer identified with it. I'm no longer caught by it. I see my reactivity. I'm not my reactivity. Does that make sense? And I'm not talking about a clinical distance from all the way across the room. I'm talking about a very, very intimate relationship with. But still, this is why the Datus, this is why the Skandhas, this is why the breaking down of experience was so emphasized. So you can begin to recognize, oh, you're not that. Yes, it's part of your experience because you're Buddha, and so you need to meet it with compassion and wisdom. But that first step of going, oh, I see it, I see it, oh, I see it, is so important. Every single time we do that, we identify ourselves with that huge, spacious consciousness that just sees it. Right? No judgment, no analysis, no picking, no choosing. I see it, I see it, I see it. Isn't that cool? Well, it is. Whether you're nodding or not, it's cool. For those of you listening to the podcast at home, everybody nodded. There we go. Okay. Okay. What else do I need to say here? Our witnessing must trust the truth of what we're witnessing. I think that is actually simple, and I think it is very difficult. Our witnessing has to trust the truth of what's being witnessed. I think we have a tendency to distrust what we experience. I think we're actually taught to mistrust and to distrust what we experience, especially emotions. Wasn't it fun to see Grandma? I don't know. It was fun to see Grandma. Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. That cigarette breath didn't bother me at all. It was fine. Right? How do you really feel about your boss? How do you really feel about your coworkers? What actually comes up around that? Well, I don't know. I'm a Buddhist. I've been Buddhist a long time, so I've pushed away all the bad stuff enough that I've actually convinced myself it's not even happening. More than that, I've taught myself to fundamentally mistrust the experience when it shows up if it's afflictive because I think I'm not supposed to have it. I've got plenty of reinforcement on this one. Catholic Church taught me that when I was a kid. Parents taught me that all the way along. Accidentally, I pulled that same thing out of Buddhism. Anger? Bad. Sadness? Bad. Grief? Bad. Judgment? Bad. Wow, geez, there's a pretty small... Yeah. No, all we can do is we do equanimity. Okay, so don't be bugged by anything, ever. Enjoy that. Loving kindness. Okay, so do that. Love everybody all the time, 100%, 24/7. Okay, 1, 2, 3, go. Compassion, we're not actually talking about the waiters. Just do the pity thing. Just be above it and say, oh, poor sweetie. Okay, then we'll just that'll be compassion, and then we'll do sympathetic joy. When your friend is happy, just be happy. We call those the immeasurables. If I'm not paying attention, I can misunderstand and go, these are the four things that's acceptable to feel. And when other stuff shows up, please distrust it, and please don't have it. And now I'm repeating the very, very same thing that was done to me when I was a kid, which is you go to your room when you're sad, and you come out when you're not. And all of a sudden, my zazen is a recreation of that very same pattern. I'm sure you do this at work. I'm sure you do this at school. I'm sure you do this in your marriage. I'm sure you do this with your kids. This is the human pattern. This is not a Busho invention. This is not a Buddhism invention. It's not a Catholic invention. It's not a Midwestern invention. It's not even an American invention. Things make us uncomfortable, and we push them away. Of course, this is the human experience. So when Dogen says something like, oh, and your enlightenment comes from that place, you know that place you keep pushing away? That's where your enlightenment is. What? Now I'm confused. Wow. Your treasure is hidden in the cave you fear to go in. Wow. So, our witnessing must trust the truth of what we're witnessing. I have to trust that feeling has got something there to show me. There's got to be a reason it's there. Now, as Buddhists, we're very, very good. I trust all of us, because we're all extremely experienced meditators, I trust. Everybody? Yes, okay, good. We're very, very good at recognizing the difference between the emotion and the narrative around the emotion. We're very good at identifying that those are two different things. And if you feel like, God, I'm the worst person in the world, the fact that you're the worst person in the world is not a fact. It's a feeling. You just feel sad. But the narrative that shows up around that feeling might be true, might not be. But we get very good at separating these things. This goes back to the skandhas again. What am I feeling? What is the mental consciousness around this, right? What is the storyline? Does that make sense? That's how all of us in this room know when we're cut off on Highway 100, right, on the way home, and we have that moment of being scared, and then the brain goes, that person's a jerk. We know that's not true. That is not true. I'm feeling scared. I am feeling angry. That is true. That person's a jerk is not true. I do not know anything about them. Does that make sense? One is the actual experience. One is the interpretation or the analysis. And we're very good at separating those two things because we do meditation every day. We're really, really good at that. And we get really, really good at knowing, oh, I'm experiencing frustration, but that doesn't mean the person next to me who's blowing their nose over and over and over is actually the devil. Right? I'm watching that thought come up, well, they must be the devil. They just keep blowing. This is like the third time she's blown. There's the fourth time she's blown her nose in this one sitting of Zazen. Well, it's obviously she's the devil. Okay, you get pretty good at going, okay, no, she is not the devil. That is not a fact, in fact. That is an angry thought. Why? Because I'm experiencing anger. Oh, hi, anger. Does that make sense? You say yes to one and no to the other. Oh, okay, I get it. We get really, really good at this. Nevertheless, we have to trust the truth of the thing we're witnessing. Oh, I see you, affliction. I trust that you're telling me something about my experience of being alive. I trust that, right? Wow. When we get good at doing that, ooh. Now the invitation is for even deeper connection with our experience, right? Mary Oliver, who the Buddhists claim, the Christians claim, the Muslims claim, you guys know Mary Oliver, right? Everybody, go to any church on any given Sunday, and somebody is going to work Mary Oliver into their Dharma talk or into their homily. I don't know. She's Mary Oliver. She belongs to the world. Beautiful poet. She says, attention, giving attention. Attention without feeling, it's only a report. Attention without feeling, it's only a report. Ooh, I love that line. Like, I can tell you what happened, but if there's no feeling there, I'm just giving you a report of facts. How was your day? I drove, and then I got cut off by a yellow car, and then I took the exit, and then I pulled in, and I put it in the park, and I turned off the car, and I came up. Not very interesting. That's a report. There's a place for reports, but the way that we witness in Zen is not giving a report. We start with the ability to recognize, oh, this is what's arising. But our relationship with experience is much warmer than just a report. The Datus, that beautiful, beautiful breakdown, is a report. It's a helpful report. It is a skillful report. It is a very sharp knife, and it is incredibly useful. But it's still a report. And because this is Mahayana Buddhism, we always have to move into, where is compassion in this? Where is the warmth in this? Where is the kindness in this? That's what we do. We can't be stuck with just the report. We've got to meet the mind, the Buddha's world mind that meets experience has to have a yes. It has to have a yes in it, doesn't it? If I'm really going to trust what's happening, there has to be some degree of yes. There has to be some degree of kindness, even a little. Because that's our relationship with experience, is to lean toward it. If I want intimacy, it can't be a report. If you've ever gone into therapy or met somebody who's gone into therapy and they start learning those first sort of therapeutic tools, you know, the way they start talking is like hilarious because it's like super, super stilted. Like, oh, you drive me crazy. I notice that you're expressing anger at me right now. And you're like, oh, you thought that was expressing anger? You're about to get popped, right? Because, and it's, they're actually learning to do something really skillful. That's actually really helpful. But it feels like a report. It feels like I'm an object. It doesn't feel like I'm not being met with kindness. I'm being reported on. Mirroring, you know? I notice you're da-da-da. I notice you're da-da-da. Yes, it's important to notice that. But do you feel it's still wanting something else? We want somebody who to lean toward us. Don't we? Isn't it fair to say that 7.5 billion of us really want somebody to lean toward us? There's only one person in your life who will always be there, who has the potential to always lean toward your experience. And you all know who that person is. It's Buddha's world. Right? You get to do that. If you want, you get to lean toward your experience that way. I got really triggered on Highway 100. He cut me right off. I felt really scared. I felt really angry. Can you just lean toward that and go, oh, yeah. What else? I get it. I'm with you. I'm with you. Don't we actually just crave that? I know we do. We absolutely crave it. Spiritually speaking, it's because they would say, on some level, you think you're separate, and on another level, you know that you're not. So why do we crave intimacy? Because it feels closer to what is true, which is that we are non-separate, right? Why do we fall in love when we lose each other in the other? Because just for a little while, you remember you're not separate. Knucklehead. That's why holding a newborn is so transformative. Oh, right? Because this little being is so close to the source. It's fresh. Out of the oven. I mean, oh my God, 5 minutes old. You can feel the non-separateness. You can just feel it, can't you? If there was a newborn baby in the middle of this room right now, you wouldn't hear a word I'm saying. You wouldn't hear it because you'd all be just like, wow, look. Oh, she sneezed. Wow. Wow. All right, I got to wrap up here. So what I'm going to say is, what I'm going to tell you is that I trust all of the strings in you. I trust your despair, and I trust your joy, and I trust all the points in between. Because you came by all those things honestly. And I don't know the details of those stories, but I trust every one of those strings. I trust them because it's Buddha's world. I trust those things. And I think that's your invitation, is to trust those things in yourself. Right? And then when you've gotten really good at doing that, you'll be able to trust them in me too. Does that make sense? So that when I show up, however I show up, you'll be able to see the non-separateness of me. You'll be able to lean toward me just a little bit. There'll be a little bit of a yes there. Because you've trusted the strings. This phenomena, this experience, this life, I believe you can meet it with reverent wakefulness. More than just reporting, more than just attention. I think you can meet it with reverence. Your sadness, your fear, your doubt, your despair. I think you can meet it with reverence because it's Buddha's world. Show me the part of this world that isn't part of Buddha's world. You can have reverence for it. I believe you can do that. I believe you can respond to the Buddha's life, which is your life, with a great yes. Yes, I will participate. I will. I'll participate. I'll see and hear and feel, smell, taste. I'll have thoughts. I'll participate. I'll bear witness. I'll feel. It's the essence of the Bodhisattva vows, right? The very first one. Suffering beings are limitless. I'll feel that. I'll respond with as much capacity as I possibly can for wisdom and for compassion and kindness. That's going to be my answer. I'm jumping in. I'm doing it. I'm saying yes. I'm going to say yes to it. I will see it. I will hear it. I will smell it. I will taste it. I will let it penetrate my marrow because I'm not separate from any of this. It is Buddha's world. No separation. So Suzuki Roshi says, wherever you are one with the clouds and one with the sun and the stars that you see. You are one with everything. That is more true than I can say. And that is more true than you can hear. Isn't that amazing? We all recognize the first half of that teaching. We've heard it 1,000 times, right? It's the core of Christianity, the core of Buddhism, the core of Judaism, the core of Islamic faith. It's non-separateness, right? You're one with everything. God, right? Wherever you are one with the clouds, one with the sun, one with the stars, one with everything. And then Suzuki, being Suzuki, says, that is more true than I can say. And that is more true than you can hear. Oh, man. Buddha's world, right? And Rumi says the same way, the same thing this way. We are the mirror as well as the face in it. We're tasting the taste this moment of eternity. We are pain and what cures pain. We are the cold, sweet water, and we are the jar that pours. So we're Buddha, and it is Buddha's world. And all of it, everything you are seeing, in yourself, outside of yourself, in your family's faces, in your neighbor's faces, on your newsfeed, that's you. All of it is us. All the pigeon calls, all the heavy bags, the valley streams, the clouds, the stars, the delusion, and the enlightenment. All the jars, and all of the cold, sweet water. So I thank you very much.